Give me that old-fashioned morphine. Give me that old-fashioned morphine. That's good enough for me.
Hi everyone, this is Lindsay Hanson Park. I'm the executive director of Sunstone and the co-host of the Sunstone Mormon History Podcast. Before we get started today, no, this is not an ad. This is a disclaimer at the beginning because the series is bringing all kinds of new listeners onto our playground. So I'm just going to give you a little brief explanation before we dive into the heavy truths of the Mormon internet and Mormon history. As executive director of the Sunstone Education Foundation, I should probably tell you what Sunstone is first. Sunstone is a nonprofit that has been around for over 45 years. It's an open forum that puts out a magazine and a symposium and a bunch of different activities in and around topics with Mormonism. It was originally founded by a bunch of college kids at Berkeley studying theology in the 1970s who wanted to talk about their religion, Mormonism, in a way that other world religions were discussing their faith. But in the Mormon tradition, it's kind of hard. It's very fraught. The stakes are very, very high. It's very political. And so people talking about Mormonism don't always do it well or don't know how to do it. What I mean about that is our community is very obsessed with talking about, is the church true? Is the church false? And when you hear that phrase, is it true? It means, are Mormonism's truth claims accurate? Is Mormonism God's one true church on earth? And in Mormon parlance, we say the church is true. It's a weird thing for outsiders to hear, I know, but that's how we talk. So for a long time, the discussion in and around any topic of Mormonism, whether it be art, poetry, politics, religion, theology, spirituality, and especially history, has to do with, does it prove that the church is the one true church on earth, or does it poke holes in it and show that it is false? And at Sunstone, we're trying to have a different conversation because as someone who, like myself, has experienced the wounds of that kind of conversation personally, we're trying to talk about faith differently. We want people to be able to discuss all the elements of the faith without having to always use it as a missionary tool to convert or deconvert from the church. Those conversations are happening everywhere in and around Mormonism, and they're just not that interesting. And not only are they not interesting, they're dangerous. As I and many of you out there who are Mormon know, these topics have very, very high value attached to them. If you lose your faith, you could lose your family, you could lose your community. And depending on what Mormon family you were raised in, depending on their level of orthodoxy, and depending on their Mormon group, depends on the loss involved. And now a note for my Mormon listeners. I use the term Mormon because it is the historically accurate term to describe all the movements that came from Joseph Smith's church. Now, you should know that there are a few movements that no longer identify with the Mormon label. Community of Christ, which was the reorganized church. The one that left with Emma Smith, which you can see depicted in the Under the Banner of Heaven series. They prefer to go with Community of Christ. They don't like the Mormon term, especially since they didn't come across with the Brighamite group, Brigham Young. They stayed back with Emma Smith. So even though they are under the Mormon umbrella, they like to be called Community of Christ. The same goes for my tradition, the mainstream tradition, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Up until a few years ago, just a very, very few years ago, when the current prophet, Russell M. Nelson, decided to distance himself and the church publicly from the term Mormon, our mainstream church were proud to be Mormons. I grew up in the generation of the prophet Gordon B. Hinckley, where we did the I'm a Mormon campaign and we had Mormon ads, and we declared publicly, I'm a Mormon, I live it, I love it. But the new guy doesn't like that term. He says using the term Mormon is a win for Satan. So when we're talking about the mainstream church, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, we'll try to use the name. But when we're talking about the large sort of the diaspora of Mormonism, we're going to use the term Mormon. We're not doing it to be offensive. We're not doing it as a win for Satan, and we're not doing it to misappropriate you. We're just doing it as a shortcut for everyone out there. So yes, Sunstone talks about all Mormon things. Science, politics, religion, poetry, art, history, theology, psychology, anything you can think of. And every year at the end of July, we have a big symposium. This year, it's July 27th through the 30th at the Mountain America Center in Sandy, Utah. You can register at sunstone.org. And anyone listening all over the world, you're invited to come. If you want to see how Mormons talk and interact, the things we study, the things we debate about, come to our Symposium. It's sort of like a Mormon Comic-Con. We have all these Mormon artists and crafters selling incredible, wonderful, hilarious, poignant Mormon art. There are Mormon booksellers there. There are Mormon poets. There are Mormon quilters that will be there. And we have about 150 presentations of everything in and around Mormonism. So you can always look that up. And you're invited to come every year at the end of July. The only thing we ask is that you allow for thoughtful discussions. You're not here to talk anyone out of their faith, and you're not there to talk anyone into it. You're there to listen, to learn, to maybe disagree, but definitely be challenged yourself and put out some interesting ideas, maybe things that people haven't heard before. This year, we're going to host a lot of panels on Under the Banner of Heaven, and we even have some of the cast coming. Tyner Rushing, who plays Emma Smith, is going to be coming and doing a presentation with Emily Palmer about Emma Smith. It's going to be incredible and beautiful. Brigham Young, Scotty Campbell, who plays Brigham Young, is going to come, and he's going to tell us some sermons in Brigham Young's voice, and I'm really excited for that. And then, of course, you can meet Brian and myself. We have this podcast, and that's the other thing I was going to tell you. This is your first time tuning in, especially if you don't know anything about Mormonism. Back all the way back up to episode one, and Brian and I bring you into the history of the church. Now, we've only been doing this podcast a little over a year and a half, which means we're only in the Nauvoo period. Even though Mormonism is new, it's only, you know, a small, early baby religion. We still have over 200 years of history, and so Brian and I are in about the first 40 years. We go into it in depth, but you'll learn more about Mormon history than you ever thought you knew. And I gotta say, Mormon or not, it is wild and fantastic to learn. I'm not just biased because I grew up Mormon. Mormonism is the story of America. If you want to know why America is the way it is, how it got into this fix that we're in, Mormons have a huge part of that. We basically colonized the American West, and our faith and politics and actions today still shape a lot of the doctrine. Did you know that the reason women can vote in the United States of America has a lot to do with Mormonism? And you'll never guess it, but Mormon polygamy. That is just one example. Our homeschooling laws in this country were shaped by Mormons. A lot of our traffic laws, a lot of our business and entrepreneurial laws are shaped by Mormonism. So we're going to get into all of that here. With that said, I know you're all eager to get into the discussion of Under the Banner of Heaven. So if you're a regular listener and you're not following online, I'm sorry for the hard break. What we're talking about on the podcast right now is the succession crisis. We're going to put a pin in it, one of our many pins. We're going to come back to it in just a few weeks. Brian and I have recorded a lot of episodes. We have a great interview with Chris Smith about the succession crisis coming up. But we're going to take a break for a minute and participate in the Cultural Zeitgeist, which is Under the Banner of Heaven. It's a show on Hulu that has been affecting our community in some pretty big ways. It started out as a book by John Krakauer that was written in the early 2000s, and it has been adapted into a limited series for FX on Hulu called Under the Banner of Heaven, and it is written by a dear friend of mine, Dustin Lance Black. I was asked to be one of the two consultants on the show. The other consultant is Troy Williams, and we're going to have him on later on, and we're going to interview him and I and talk about our work on the show. But Brian Buchanan and I, my co-host, want to dive into the history because Brian helped me on a lot of the research on the show. Over the course of the series, I had to research things I never would have thought the level of detail was needed. Like, for example, if you watch episode 5, the car chase with Dan Lafferty, I researched the route of the car chase, what it looked like, where they drove, who they talked to, what officer was involved, all of that kind of stuff just for that one scene. So we're going to dive into all of those nitty gritty details. We're going to pull heavily from the research that Dustin Lance Black used. He's agreed generously to share his files with us, and we're going to parse out fact from fiction. I'm incredibly excited to do this. It's very important, especially since there's a lot of, I don't know, mythos around what is true and what is false out there. There's a lot of conversation, a lot of feelings, a lot of emotions, especially in the Mormon community, and people want to say what is true and what is false. This podcast is going to get into it. We're going to do it over the course of several episodes, and rather than releasing them every other week, for the next few weeks, we're going to release one every week so we can dive in and talk about it. And then, Sunstone Podcast listeners, I promise we will bring you back to the succession crisis and get back into the swing of things. If you know me, me. I hate going out of order. I hate it. But we're going to go in order for the show right now. So if you haven't been watching the series, maybe follow along. Go check it out on Hulu. It is extremely triggering if you're a Mormon, and you'll have a lot of strong opinions, and that's okay. It's a television show. It's supposed to spark those kind of conversations. And oh boy, has it sparked conversations within our faith community. All of that said, today you're going to have to be a little patient because we got to start some groundwork. We're going to assume that a lot of you don't know anything about Mormonism, let alone Mormon fundamentalism. And if you just heard my rant at the beginning about being mainstream and not using the term Mormon or using the term Mormon, you're going to get an inkling into how fraught this space is. So today, before we get into episode one, which we're going to get to in just a week, we have to give you some groundwork. We're going to talk about what Mormon fundamentalism is, how it even happens, because hopefully, as you're seeing in the series, there's not one kind of Mormonism. At Sunstone, our tagline is there's more than one way to Mormon. And we're not saying that to be funny. We're saying it because it's true. There are over 487 extant expressions of Mormonism, if historian and researcher Steve Shields is to be believed, and he's an excellent researcher. He's tracked all of these different groups in Mormonism, and the mainstream, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, which I grew up in, is only one of them. So we've got to explain to you how that happened. And to do that, we brought on one of the best, Christina Rossetti, Dr. Christina Rossetti. She is a non-Mormon scholar. She's actually a Catholic studying Mormonism. So she doesn't have skin in the faith politics game, but her motivation is truth and accuracy, and she's one of the best out there. So she is going to parse out how Mormon fundamentalism starts. Her and Brian are going to give you an excellent, excellent explanation of how the mainstream church turned into all these different breakoff groups and why people like the Laffertys are going to be able to believe and think as they do. By the time we talk next week, we'll have all the episodes out, so we'll be able to talk freely without, you know, any of the constraints that I had. I had to wait till the show's finally out to talk about all of it, but it'll be out, so we'll be able to dive into it. And so for now, we're going to talk about Prophet Onias, which just showed up in episode 6. We're going to talk about how Mormon fundamentalists and Mormon polygamy starts. And you're going to become an expert on Mormon fundamentalism, and you didn't even know that you were going to be or that you wanted to be. But Brian and Christina's excellent research are going to give you a primer into that. And I have to say, this is not a podcast for dummies. So if you're dumb, not really interested in learning some really good scholarly details, that's okay. We want to turn you into scholars. We want everyone to engage in the meat and the documents and the heady stuff. And so Brian and Christina are going to do that for you. And then next week, we're going to start picking apart episode one, scene by scene, telling you what's true, what's not, why some of the choices were made, some of my experience working on the series. It's going to be awesome. But until then, you should tune in. If you haven't, you should be watching the show. Love it or hate it, we're going to help you figure this out and help you understand the real story behind it. We're going to talk to some of the folks involved in the real story. We're going to look over the documents and help you sort it out. But for now, let's give you Brian and Christina talking about the history of Mormon fundamentalism. Hi, this is Lindsay Hanson Park.
And this is Brian Buchanan.
Bringing you the story of Mormonism from the shadow of the everlasting hills, straight out of Zion. This isn't your grandpa's Mormon history.
I have sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young.
That only this is the tale of Mormon me, saints and sinners, Brigham, from our roots young, until present day. Saddle up.
Gird your loins, lock your hearts, and pay your tithing, because we're bringing you the story of Mormonism in all its paradisiacal glory.
It's the Sunstone History Podcast.
Well, I have sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. That only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. That only you can save me, Brother Young.
Welcome, listeners, old and new. We're doing a special series of episodes to discuss the streaming series Under the Banner of Heaven. And unless you've been in a cave or you are trapped at Desnet headquarters right now, you are undoubtedly aware that this series has created intense buzz and a lot of discussion. So Over the next few weeks, we're going to talk about various elements of the series. We'll talk about the historical flashbacks. We'll talk about the Laffertys themselves. And then we'll talk about the larger issues within Mormonism that the series tries to get at. And don't worry, we'll get back to our Succession Crisis episodes, so don't forget that whole mess. But to begin with tonight, we are very excited to have a very good friend of the podcast, Dr. Christina Rossetti, back with us.
Oh, hi. I'm Christina. I study Mormon fundamentalism, mainly St. Joey White Messer and Friends. See what I did there?
Now, you probably know Christina if you follow Mormon studies at all. She's very active on Twitter, on Facebook. She's written quite a few articles that have been published in Dialogue, Journal of Mormon History, other places. And she has a very fun forthcoming book. Tell us a little bit about that one.
University of Illinois is doing a great series. They're short intellectual biographies of great kind of foundational Mormon thinkers. And so think like Eugene England. I don't know. I think someone's doing like Parley Pratt. And then I just snuck Joseph Messer right in there as the foundation of Mormon fundamentalism, or at least what I think is. And so I'm really excited to have my favorite Mormon fundamentalist thinker in a long line of really rad Latter-day Saints and Mormons.
Heber J. Grant probably doesn't love that he's included in the series, but the rest of us are happy for it. So sorry, Heber.
Who amongst? All right.
Yeah, he fits there. He's worthy of it. Well, there are many perspectives by which one can understand the tragic story of what happens to Brender Lafferty. And one of these is to look at how the Lafferty brothers journeyed deep into Mormon fundamentalism. And this is a specific slice of Mormon history that gets frequently overlooked. And especially for the non-Mormon watchers and listeners, this part of the history is likely going to be completely foreign territory. So bring us in, Dr. R. Let's talk some context here.
So we're going to go way back. 19th century, there's a guy, his name's Joseph Smith. You might have heard of him. He founded Mormonism, and he saw a lot of his work as a great project of restoration. Importantly, he wasn't the only restorationist, but he did some unique things. In his role as God's mouthpiece, he brought together the world into this complete whole, free of corruption, free of abomination, and restored everything to its pristine setting. Not quite its paradisaical glory or whatever, however you all say that word, but very close. And as part of the restoration, the biblical concept of polygamy was brought back into the equation. And hints of the practice came within just a few years of the founding of Mormonism. During the Kirtland period, Joseph Smith entered in some sort of relationship with a young woman named Fanny Alger. She was a teenager who had lived in the Smith home. And while later accounts would describe their relationship as the first polygamous relationship, we really don't have a lot of contemporary sources of what exactly happened. What is clear is that it didn't end well, but that was the end of polygamy for a little bit.
So with one possible exception, and we've talked about this story earlier, Joseph Smith basically hits pause on the polygamy program for about 5 years until the Mormons were now living in Nauvoo. Then during the last 3 years of his life, Smith married about 30 women, and many of those were unknown to his first wife, Emma. And somewhere Tyner, who expertly plays Emma in the series, is getting sad just knowing that we're talking about this tonight. And all of these relationships were enmeshed in a growing theology and ritual. And all of this operated almost entirely behind the scenes in Nauvoo. Joseph Smith would slowly introduce trusted associates to this practice, and then they gradually joined in this secretive society. And together, this becomes the underground Nauvoo that's going on pretty much without the knowledge of most people living there.
And part of this development was the introduction of various rituals that both rewarded loyalty to Smith and helped ensure secrecy. A washing and anointing happened early on with cinnamon whiskey, story for a different time, accompanied by a ritual drama, and that became the endowment. And this was administered to the gradually expanded group, often called the Anointed Quorum. Those invited into the inner circle were usually those to whom Smith had presented the doctrine of polygamy. Soon the prophet heightened the sense of privilege by bestowing another higher ordinance known as the second anointing. And this highest blessing was available to Mormons on earth and promised a literal godhood to the recipients with the eternal prospect of ruling over their own kingdom, world without end. Amen.
As we've been talking about on the podcast lately, Joseph Smith's death in 1844 throws everything into this very uncertain chaos. And as we were going to discuss soon, after we finish this series of episodes, one of Brigham Young's most persuasive arguments, at least to the guys in that inner circle, was two-pronged. First, Brigham Young had been polygamy's most staunch defender. From the very beginning that he heard about it, he was on board. As a result, he had been able to participate in all the rituals that Joseph Smith had introduced, and crucially, he planned to continue them. And as a result of that, Mormon traditions that stem from Brigham Young would look very different from those that didn't. Polygamy, temple ordinances. It's a very simple, but also a very potent recipe.
And it worked. Over the next 50 years in Utah, polygamy became so intertwined with the Brighamite Mormon identity that it essentially became Mormonism. Utah Mormons would listen to countless sermons where they heard Brigham Young preach that the only men who become gods, even the sons of gods, are those who enter into polygamy. And John Taylor state plainly, when this commandment was given, it was so far religious and so far binding upon the elders of this church that it was told them if they were not prepared to enter into it and to stem the torrent of opposition that would come in consequence of it, the keys of the kingdom would be taken from them. Bum, bum, bum.
Opposition, you say, Elder Taylor? Yeah, there's going to be a little of that. Beginning with the Federal Moral Act in 1862, which was really never enforced, the government forced the LDS Church to its knees, just as effectively as the Nature Boy or the Macho Man ever made any dude submit in the ring. Because Brigham Young, he was not about to give in to some Nancy boys in Washington. You could send armies out to Utah, he didn't really care. His successor, John Taylor, remember, had said that if you don't do polygamy, the keys of the kingdom are going to get yeeted from you. So that sets the stage for a showdown in the 1880s. In this corner, standing 5'11", and hey, it was the 19th century, that was quote-unquote tall. You've got John Taylor, the British Bantam himself. In the other corner are about a billion congressmen and the president and all of the newspapers and basically the whole world.
Okay. Hey. Despite everything, John Taylor went out in a blaze of glory. He's 100% my favorite LDS prophet, really the last of the badass prophets, no contest. In his last public sermon, he rehearsed the familiar tales of Mormon persecution, whipping the crowd into a fervor. He then asked rhetorically if he would give up polygamy and thundered, "No, never, no, never, no, never. I can endure more than I have done, and all that God will enable me to endure, I can die for the truth." Taylor then went into hiding on the now legendary Mormon Underground. And for the last 2 years of his life, he moved from place to place, backed by a network of bodyguards and spotters to keep him out of the hands of the hated federal marshals, constantly trying to nab him. It's not going to end well.
Unlike Brigham Young, John Taylor was actually very much down with issuing the old school revelations. He'd bring the heat with, "Thus saith the Lord." A few years before this underground period started, in 1882, there were a few vacancies in the Quorum of the Apostles. And the rest of the quorum submitted their suggestions, but they didn't jive with Taylor's feelings. So playing the ultimate card that he could, he presented a revelation to his colleagues. And that revelation appointed George Teasdale and Heber J. Grant as the replacement apostles. And then another man was appointed to a position provided that he got his butt in gear to, quote, "conform to my law." And no one in this meeting was confused by what this meant. Wilford Woodruff recorded in his diary that John Taylor explained to them what Joseph Smith had taught about polygamy and then warned, quote, "If we do not embrace that principle soon, the keys will be turned against us. For if we do not keep the same law our Heavenly Father has, we cannot go with him." And what I find so interesting is that revelation was never included in the English editions of the Doctrine and Covenants, but it was included in several foreign language editions. So this wasn't just idle talk. This was serious business.
And it's only going to get better. One of John Taylor's stops on the underground was the home of John W. Woolley in Centerville. The W stands for Wickersham. It's my favorite. middle name. Here on September 27th, 1886, he recorded the infamous 1886 revelation, sometimes called the 8-hour meeting, in his own hand. And this is even more pointed than the 1882 revelation. This message declared, quote, "Thus saith the Lord, all commandments that I give must be obeyed by those calling themselves by my name, unless they are revoked by me or by my authority. And how can I revoke an everlasting covenant? For I, the Lord, am everlasting, and my everlasting covenants cannot be abrogated nor done away with, but they stand forever." The revelation made it clear that all those who wanted to enter into the Lord's glory must do the work of Abraham. Time to polygamy up, my dudes.
I think we give bonus points for using abrogate correctly in a sentence.
I read that a couple times.
It's a good vocabulary builder. But despite the forceful content and the use of the word abrogate, this revelation really did not have a lot of impact in the larger Mormon world. Both John Taylor and his host, John Woolley, did marry plural wives right after this revelation, but the revelation was not publicized. And honestly, it doesn't seem like any of Taylor's colleagues in church leadership even knew that it existed. So we have one mention of it in a journal in 1889, and then John W. Taylor brings it up a couple times in the apostles' meetings. Outside of that, the revelation is basically out of sight. But hang on to that thought for just a few minutes, though.
And it is worth noting that in some accounts, they mention Taylor levitating and having a glowing countenance. But I digress. Polygamy at this time had been declared illegal by the Supreme Court in 1879, and then two more pieces of anti-polygamy legislation in the 1880s at the federal level really ramped up the heat. So in 1882, the same year that John Taylor has the first revelation about polygamy, the Edmonds Act passed. This really changed the game by making unlawful cohabitation illegal rather than just your run-of-the-mill polygamy. Proving a polygamous marriage had been performed was difficult, really difficult. But the standard of proof was much, much lower for unlawful cohabitation. Really, folks, you're just living with someone. An amendment to this act called the Edmonds-Tucker Act was passed 5 years later, adding some serious teeth to the situation. The LDS Church ceased to exist, but really it stopped existing. The act disincorporated the church, yanked the vote back from women, and replaced local judges who had been Mormon with federal appointees. Any property worth more than $50,000 was confiscated. This, of course, meant three completed temples and the in-process Salt Lake Temple. This is a big deal. This is where people are getting married. This is where like eternal ordinances happen and they're gone. Mormons appealed and they went to the Supreme Court, but of course they upheld everything.
Then by 1890, you've got two more things converging. The Mormon desire for Utah to become a state, which they had been working on for 40 years at this point, had not gone away, and they were still working furiously to make it happen. There were bribes, there were many lobbyists, they were doing everything they could. Also, another bill was working its way toward passage. This one would have disenfranchised all Mormons everywhere, period. There had been a test oath that had been applied in Idaho, and that had gone to the Supreme Court and had been upheld, and that was scary. So it was very clear to Church President Wilford Woodruff that something has got to be done. The solution was to issue an official declaration or manifesto on September 25th, 1890. And you'll note that this is 4 years almost to the date from John Taylor's 1886 revelation. And eagle-eyed observers noted a couple curious things, however. This statement went out under Woodruff's name alone, not the entire First Presidency. Also in this statement, Woodruff wrote that it is, quote, "my advice to the Latter-day Saints to refrain from contracting any marriage forbidden by the law of the land." Yeah, advice is not usually the kind of statement you expect from a church president.
It's a different vibe than "thus saith the Lord." And I mean, for that reason and others, the fact of the matter is that church leaders didn't intend to end polygamy. As Mike Quinn has noted, on the day that the manifesto was voted on in general conference, Woodruff signed recommends for 7 plural marriages. However, all of these were performed in Mexico. The thinking was, we'll say we're abiding by the law of the land by sending people to be married outside the U.S., mostly in Mexico, with some in Canada too. Now, sometimes you'll hear that they did this because polygamy wasn't illegal in either Mexico or Canada. This is nonsense. There were perfectly good laws against polygamy on the books in both countries, just like the US. However, Mormon leaders had what was essentially handshake agreements with government leaders, particularly in Mexico, that if the people were going to stay and live in their countries and wouldn't cause any problems, they wouldn't bother prosecuting.
However, in 1891, Wilford Woodruff and his buddies had to go before a specially appointed judge and argue that the government should give back all this stuff that had been confiscated. And this series of testimonies is a very fascinating and underappreciated event. And friend of the podcast, John Dinger, and I are actually working on a project that deals with this testimony. Because Woodruff, for example, under oath, is led to see things like this, quote, the manifesto, quote, was to announce to the world that the plural marriages had been forbidden by the church and they could not be practiced hereafter. Also, quote, any person entering into plural marriage after that date would be liable to become excommunicated from the church. He also stated that neither he nor any other church leader had, quote, advised, encouraged, or assented to the practice of bigamy, polygamy, or plural marriage by any members of the church. And then further, Woodruff said that the manifesto applied to existing marriages, not just the new ones. Finally, he also stated that it applied everywhere, not just the U.S.
But hold on to your hats. With this in mind, here's this next sentence. Over the next 15 years, more than 250 plural marriages were performed. That doesn't quite sound like ending plural marriage to me. Now, it is accurate to say that it started to be restricted somewhat. These new marriages were mostly for leaders, think bishops, stake presidents, and mission presidents, etc. Randos in the pews made up a pretty small percentage of the marriages performed thereafter. Lest you think that it was just guys going rogue doing these marriages, it was all with approval. All three members of the first presidency and most of the apostles were involved to some degree, marrying wives themselves, performing the marriages, or at least encouraging them.
However, life was mostly quiet through the 1890s despite all of this going on. Plural marriages did keep happening, and plenty of them were right here in the good old U.S. of A. There were some occasional little dust-ups, like when the Salt Lake Tribune publicized that new church president Lorenzo Snow had had a child with his plural wife. That made it very clear that the manifesto did not mean stop cohabiting with your wives, at least to him. And honestly, things probably would have stayed fairly quiet if not for a very, very bad decision by Joseph F. Smith. What happened? 1903, Apostle Reed Smoot, with hearty encouragement from now church president Joseph F. Smith, remember the F, damn it, was elected by the Utah legislature as one of the state's two senators. That made him the first and only senator or apostolator. He had a fancy chair in Salt Lake as one of the apostles, but he also had one in Washington as a senator. Onlookers, seeing what's going on, had had enough of all this Mormon nonsense. Protests signed by millions, literally millions of people, poured into Washington. A four-year series of hearings ensued to determine whether old Smoot would get to keep his seat. The thing was, Smoot wasn't actually a polygamist, but lots of his colleagues were, and it had become clear the 1890 manifesto really hadn't changed much.
Virtually all church leaders were subpoenaed to come back to the District of Columbia and be grilled about this issue. There were some notable exceptions. Apostle Mariner Merrill, the hardest name apostle to say, who had performed a bunch of polygamous marriages in the Logan Temple, where he was temple president. And remember, friends, Logan is in the United States, pleaded that he was in bad health. It's true. He was. Apostle George Teasdale, who had similarly performed a pile of marriages in Mexico, also played the old and sick card. Also true. He was old and sick. However, two others definitely were not old and or sick. Apostles John W. Taylor, son of glowing countenance John Taylor, and especially Matthias F. Cowley were quietly told to stay out of sight. Whenever anyone back in Washington asked where these two were, Joseph F. Smith would just throw his hands up and say, guys, I tried my best. Honestly, we just can't seem to find them anywhere. Amazingly, this worked, and neither had to testify, which would have been a complete disaster. Cowley had performed dozens of marriages, some of those of people who were testifying, and a lot of them had been in the U.S. And I personally always wonder why Cowley isn't the one mighty and strong.
Who's to say he's not? I mean, it's It's an open-ended question at this point. The thing was, is during the testimony thus far, Joseph F. Smith had been bad enough of a PR dumpster fire. He wouldn't answer questions directly. He was a little combative at times, and easily the most newsworthy item comes when his plural wife gives birth to a son during the hearings. It's pretty good evidence. Plural marriage is continuing. You'll remember, Lindsay and I frequently remind you that Mormons are not always great at reading the room. So Joseph F. is ordered to both remember the F and pay a pretty hefty fine, which of course makes the newspaper. That is the fine part, not the remembering the F part. That did not make the news. All right, back to Taylor and Cowley, though. Reed Smoot is getting hounded back in Washington, even by Mr. Speak Softly and carrying a big effing stick himself, Teddy Roosevelt, who actually really likes Smoot. He just doesn't love polygamy. And Smoot, remember, not a polygamist. And frankly, he's kind of embarrassed by his colleagues, who he kind of sees as relics of this older Mormonism. So Smoot pressures the boys back in Utah to do something dramatic. I mean, this is just 1890 happening all over again.
So step one, issue another official declaration. Easy said, easy done. In the April 1904 General Conference, Joseph F. Smith puts on his manifesto hat and tells the world, no, really, guys, we're really done with polygamy this time. Pinky promise. Usually called the Second Manifesto, the statement declares that anyone who does polygamy going forward will be excommunicated. Remember that even though the 1890 manifesto hadn't mentioned punishment for infractions, Wilford Woodruff had testified under oath a year later that that's what would happen for new marriages. But not surprisingly, reactions for this manifesto 2.0 were pretty meh. Been there, done that. In Joseph Musser's diary, he actually writes, like, Joseph F. Smith commented about polygamy anyway. I'm on the statute committee for the stake. It was a nothing burger.
Didn't go over with a lot of impact for Musser or for a lot of people. Step two was a little more robust than this, though. A year after that second manifesto, John W. Taylor and Matthias Cowley were dropped from the Quorum of the Apostles after a lot of discussion. And this was not really a very popular decision, even among the apostles. And onlookers, both inside the church and out, mostly concluded this was just a political move, and you can't really blame them. However, this time, church leaders meant business, mostly. I mean, you can't just shut something like this off cold turkey. Doesn't work. Mike Quinn has documented a few additional marriages that Joseph F. Smith authorized after the Second Manifesto, but we're talking about just a handful. So does that mean polygamy's done?
Absolutely not. You can't preach for 60 years that polygamy is necessary for your exaltation, and you have to do the works of Abraham and how polygamy produces even physically superior children, etc., and just expect people to flip the switch and be like, okay, cool, we're done now. We see a shift now, though. Matthias Cowley, who had previously performed dozens of marriages, apparently started to reroute people to patriarchs to perform these marriages. For all the non-Mormon listeners, my people, patriarchs were older men who were appointed on a local level to give people special blessings that served basically as a roadmap for their lives. Through some creative applications of Mormon scripture, some of them felt they were authorized now to also perform plural marriages. Since the message that polygamy was really over was becoming more entrenched, they acted now in heightened security.
The very first time I went on Year of Polygamy with Lindsay, we talked about this fascinating period. I am endlessly interested by this. Mormons have had this long history of telling the public one thing about polygamy and then doing the opposite behind the scenes. This goes back to Nauvoo. Polygamy deniers, of course, conclude from this that Joseph Smith just never did polygamy, which is two things. One, complete nonsense, and two, it's not really the point here, and my apologies. Okay, we're back on topic now. We get some accounts from this period that are pretty wild. Marriages being performed in ice houses, the dudes performing the marriages wearing masks, that kind of thing. It's weird. It's almost like doing things in secret breeds weirdness.
Does it? Maybe. Yes. But all that to say, a very loose network of dudes kind of starts to develop here. They seem to be directed in a mostly hands-off way by Matthias Cowley, my one mighty and strong, who's pulling the strings for actions performed by patriarchs. There's some half-hearted attempt by church leaders to investigate, but again, this period is super murky. One guy they bring in for questioning swears up and down that he was authorized by Joseph F. Smith, and, well, no one really wants to pull that string too hard. But then in July 1909, the hammer finally falls. A committee is formed of a few apostles to really get serious about this. The Salt Lake Tribune has been publishing pretty spicy content, including lists of post-manifesto polygamists, and some of them are in fairly public positions. The thing is, this project doesn't originate with Church President Joseph F. Smith, but from the president of the Apostles' Quorum, Francis M. Lyman. That's what's wild is Lyman is a polygamist himself. He is practicing the principle. His last child was born during the Smoot hearings.
The rest of this story is very simple. It's just that Spider-Man meme over and over. Everybody just pointing at the other Spider-Man. One quick tangent for non-Mormon listeners. If you haven't already picked up on this, Mormons, particularly the LDS ones and the offshoots they're from, are absolutely obsessed with priesthood authority. This, of course, had been one of the main selling points of Mormonism with Joseph Smith, the necessary priesthood authority to perform ordinances, to act in the name of God, and so on, had been lost after the New Testament era and had needed to be restored. And this authority could be really specific. It might just be the authorization to perform one specific task, like perform a plural marriage. And the authority to do these specific things is called keys. So from this point forward, all of our actors are going to play a spirited game of keys, keys, who's got the keys? And what if these keys to perform plural marriages get super decentralized? Gets outside the radar of the apostles, for example.
Damage control. That's what happens. So this committee that formed in 1909 immediately goes to work. They bring in various dudes to just grill them on the entire situation. Some are the patriarchs who are performing plural marriage. Others are people who are having their marriages performed by these patriarchs, people like Joseph Musser. I know quite a bit about him. The apostles gradually realize that these marriages have been performed by this underground network, and they're pissed. They start excommunicating mostly ones who are performing the marriages. It's a very weird dynamic because Joseph F. Smith, the president of the entire church, is almost never present at these interrogations, and they really kind of tiptoe around him for the most part.
The F is just a giant elephant in the room, and everybody knows that. And these excommunications that happen are huge because they mark a very distinct watershed. This doublespeak of earlier years has burned off, and clear distinctions begin to emerge out of this. After 1909, if you enter into a polygamous relationship, you can be sure you are going to get your butt handed to you if Francis Lyman finds out about it. He is relentless. So John W. Taylor and Matthias Cowley during this process get hauled back in yet again, because John W. Taylor had married another wife in 1909, and Cowley was very likely the guy who performed it. Taylor gets excommunicated, even though he tries to base his case during the trial on his father's 1886 revelation. They're not having it. Cowley, who performed the marriage, oddly enough, he's less combative, and so he gets a compromise solution. He is not excommunicated. This is a mistake that pops up in books all the time. He is actually deprived of the right to use priesthood authority. And that's very interesting because, as Mike Quinn points out, that meant he could still go to sacrament meetings. He could still actually speak. And that puts him in a very odd position because he's kind of still a member, but kind of not. He's not really an apostle, but he's also not completely not an apostle. So he's in a weird limbo place. And some of these other guys that are getting disciplined decide that they would rather be members of the church in good standing than continue in polygamy. Others of them, however, are not about to give in. Grandpa went to jail for this, not about to give up the farm. You know, that kind of mindset. So what all this does is just drive things further out of sight. As a result, the 1910s might even be more murky than the 1900s had been. And now we get to see some new participants in the story. One of them is John Woolley. Remember, he was the one that hosted John Taylor on the Underground, and it was at his house that Taylor had the 1886 revelation. In 1914, John W. Woolley gets excommunicated himself, of course, after Francis Lyman gets wind of him performing marriages. What's interesting is in an affidavit that he signs, Woolley will claim that Matthias Cowley had been sending people to him.
Our one mighty and strong. But no, really. After all the excommunications, people really have to choose this new course of action. Sadly, we don't know much about this decade as we would like to. Ding, ding, free dissertation idea. There are undoubtedly journals and other records that are sitting in basements and libraries that hold vital pieces of information that we and others are desperately trying to unearth. John Woolley continues to perform plural marriages, and there are likely others doing it too. But again, this period still needs a lot of historical work. As the 1920s begin, we get another major development. This is one of the most fascinating stories of fundamentalist history. If you are listening to this with headphones, you're already part of the story and you didn't even know. Nathaniel Baldwin is an inventor in Salt Lake City, and his diaries have wild invention doodles in the margins. And he had been responsible for getting the first good pair of headphones into production. I know, I have a pair of them. They're framed on my wall. They're super rad.
Polygamy's everywhere. You didn't even know it intersected with headphones, though. You're welcome. This Mr. Nathaniel Baldwin has a roaring factory up in Mill Creek here in Salt Lake, where guys are churning out headphones and other radio equipment. Here's the other element of the story. Mr. Baldwin is a fundamentalist himself. This goes back to his days as a professor in BYU, where he was scoping out potential plural wives. But to keep it secret, he wrote about it in his journal using the Greek alphabet. And it is one of my most proudest achievements because I figured it out. I actually had the very memorable occasion of talking to Mike Quinn about this, sitting at the microfilm machines at the Church History Library. And he told me how he hadn't been able to crack these entries. This is the very definition of putting on your nerd hat.
So Baldwin, with his Greek alphabet, starts to attract all these guys who feel like he does. Guys like Joseph Musser, guys like John Y. Barlow and Lyman Jessup, who had been all excommunicated for polygamy. And guys like John Woolley, John Wickersham Woolley, and his son, Lorne Woolley. They would frequently stay after work and talk about the fullness of the gospel. Really, polygamy was the common topic. Lorne Woolley begins by telling these guys about an incredible experience. Remember back to the underground days of 1886 when John Taylor has the revelation about polygamy never being revoked? The glowing countenance, levitation, all that. This is why we wanted you to put a pin in it. Lorne tells eager listeners that the revelation wasn't the end of the story. On September 26, 1886, at a Sunday meeting at the John Woolley House in Centerville, something mind-blowing, more mind-blowing than a glowing countenance, takes place.
In this meeting, which took 8 hours, John Taylor had ordained men to perform plural marriages. Two of the guys were Lorne himself and his father, John Woolley. Taylor warned them that the time would come when the LDS Church would shut polygamy down, and this would happen in the days of the seventh president. Well, all these dudes listening to Lorne Woolley, as he's telling all these stories, are of course aware that the current president of the LDS Church, Heber J. Grant, who had been a polygamist himself, was, dun dun dun, the seventh president, of course. Daniel Bateman, who had also been on the scene in 1886 as a bodyguard, backed up everything Lorne Woolley said. Jesus Christ and Joseph Smith had been at this meeting, and John Taylor had, in fact, ordained these men. One of them had been his father, Samuel Bateman. Well, it's time for Brian to get up on his soapbox here, because the TLDR, as I see it, is this. The Lorne Woolley story just doesn't hold up. And I really don't have a dog in this fight. It doesn't matter to me one way or the other. It's kind of like when Lindsay and I did that episode talking about the increasingly popular idea that Joseph Smith wasn't a polygamist. I just don't have a side to choose in these discussions. Frankly, I just don't like bad history. That's it. That's my side. Because there's really no contemporary evidence for John Taylor ordaining these dudes in 1886. In fact, the story that Christina and I have been weaving up until now has demonstrated a very different narrative than what Lorne Woolley was telling.
And possibly, unlike Brian, I desperately wanted it to be true. And it's just not. I just don't see it being part of the historical record. Anyway, I digress again. The men that Lorne Woolley names are nowhere to be found as far as performing polygamous marriages after 1886. Even when John Woolley does start marrying people, he says that it was due to Matthias Cowley, not some special ordination. He's just like other patriarchs who are doing marriages, not some kind of fancy, special, unique case. Just like the original Mormon Foundation narrative with Joseph Smith, Lauren Woolley provides a sense of order for all of these men who've coalesced together. They've been excommunicated from the church they love, they're very bitter, and they're trying to reconcile everything. Woolley's account gives their pain and continued desire to live the principle of polygamy meaning and purpose. His listeners are electrified and now have an identity. They see themselves like a special department of the LDS Church, one that will ensure that plural marriages continue forever. Like countless others before them with various different motivations, they look forward to the coming of the one mighty and strong, a figure mentioned in one of Joseph Smith's revelations, who I've joked about might be Matthias Cowley. And he will set this church back in order, validating their course and validating the perpetuation of polygamy.
So at this point, Lauren Woolley becomes the de facto leader of this burgeoning movement. And in later accounts, Lauren cautioned them against becoming a structured organization. Their mission there was very specific. They were there to perpetuate the fullness of the gospel. That's it. However, there were various other principles like the Adam God doctrine, consecration, Kingdom of God, and so on. This is part of their mindset, but polygamy is always at the heart of their mission. So in these meetings that are held at the Radio Factory or the houses of these guys, Lauren Woolley and Daniel Bateman will continually share their fervent witness of this alternate reality Mormonism. It's incredibly powerful. New people keep coming to these meetings. And part of the message here is that the church and the priesthood are actually two separate discussions. They can exist apart from one another. And some of the people that are attending these meetings will actually continue their membership in the LDS Church until, of course, they're discovered and then summarily excommunicated.
And throughout the 1920s, the movement ends up gathering adherents to the fundamentalist message. Members of the LDS Church, many of them children of earlier authorized polygamists, are drawn to this group who are continuing the legacy of what they call the principle. Then, in 1929, two developments give the movement a much clearer mission. Joseph Musser urges the documentation of Lauren Woolley's account of the 1886 event, which Lauren signs. The same year, Lauren Woolley begins to ordain men to a council of friends, giving them the same authority he testified he had received from John Taylor. Over the next 20 years, the council will operate on the same principle as the LDS Church. When the head of the council dies, the senior member succeeds him. However, just like in the mainstream church, which Brian and Lindsay have been expertly talking about, these transitions are not without controversy. For example, when John Y. Barlow assumes leadership in 1935, the next senior member, Joseph Musser, is thought by many to be the rightful successor. He even asks Barlow if he has the keys. Barlow says no. Musser, a much more charismatic figure, is seen by the community as really the Joseph Smith to John Y. Barlow's more dictatorial Brigham Young personality.
So contrary to Lauren Woolley's apparent instructions, this movement starts to take on all the trappings of an organized church. Baptisms are performed, priesthood ordinations happen, they give financial donations, they publish things, etc. It starts to look like a church. The earlier, more gentle rhetoric about the LDS Church starts to fade away. But honestly, that's not unexpected given the way this group is dealt with. Heber J. Grant and his counselor, J. Reuben Clark, operate on the Francis Lyman program. No carrots, only sticks for these guys. In 1933, they issue yet another statement, the third, the last, the final manifesto. This one is much longer than the earlier two and is way more tough than the predecessors have been. And this document begins a history of disingenuous, frequently outright false statements by LDS leaders regarding all of this. So Grant, president of the church by this point, had heard John W. Taylor discuss the 1886 revelation on several occasions. He had probably seen at least a copy of it, but in this statement, he insists that the revelation doesn't exist. Not a great idea. Now, one quick tangent here. By this point, and definitely going forward, the phrase 1886 revelation starts to become shorthand for the whole enchilada. It's not just the revelation text, but it's also this account of John Taylor ordaining men to keep polygamy alive forever. It's the whole package. And that was really Lauren Woolley's lasting influence, was he squished those two ideas together, and they are inextricably entwined from that point on. So when somebody says, I don't believe in the 1886 revelation, you have to unpack that. So personally, following Mike Quinn's lead on this, I feel like what you have to do is uncouple this back into the two separate discussions. You have the John Taylor revelation text, which exists, somewhere, and we've got photos of it, and it's undoubtedly authentic. There's just absolutely no reason to claim that it doesn't. Then you have the ordinations, which I just don't see any evidence for those.
And I mean, even Leonard Arrington in his diaries, the church historian, said it was authentic. And if someone's going to know, it was Leonard Arrington. But anyway, as the 1930s progressed, the LDS Church ramps up their opposition to this potent movement. They quietly give assistance to law enforcement, even, who begin arresting and even jailing polygamists. A 1935 raid focused on men living in Short Creek, a lonely sanctuary straddling the Utah-Arizona border, and the fiercely committed community hearkened back to Brigham Young's model of planting towns in extremely difficult circumstances in order to prove their mettle. Back at LDS headquarters, loyalty oaths are drafted for problem areas, which result in more church discipline. By the end of the decade, a coordinated system of surveillance documents those who attend fundamentalist meetings. Robust cooperation with various officials nets information on license plates. The info is then passed on to church leaders, who then take action. It's a whole thing. The movement was undeterred by these efforts, though, and LDS leaders were not happy that the group continued to woo away their members. Again, with LDS support, another sweep ensues. This time, 15 men go to prison in 1945. Despite their tough talks about Wilford Woodruff's manifesto, which, as we discussed, wasn't really intended to actually stop polygamy, the jailed fundamentalists found it more difficult to hold the line from behind bars and signed their own statement in order to leave prison. It didn't go unnoticed that this prison manifesto was signed 55 years, again, almost to the day, after Woodruff's despised covenant with death and agreement with hell.
I find that episode fascinating because all the leaders, the guys that you've heard of from this movement, John Mybarlow, Joseph Musser, Rulon Allred, all sign this agreement and leave. You do have four guys that don't and stay in prison. They're not the leaders, and you don't really hear as much about them. Very interesting.
And it's a lasting conflict in the fundamentalist movement of like, my leader didn't sign it. My leader did.
It's that people remember who did and who didn't for sure. So during this period, you have a conflict of personality and goals between your council head, John Mybarlow, and then the second in command, Joseph Musser, and that spreads to the community. After Barlow passes away in 1949, Musser assumes the leadership, but his health almost immediately begins to decline. He has a couple strokes. He's not doing so hot. Then we have two major conflicts that will introduce an ominous wedge into the movement. First, you have some underage placement marriages. So the priesthood head says who marries who, that started during John Mybarlow's tenure, that resulted in some sharp disagreements. The more lasting one, however, is Joseph Musser's decision to bypass the president and his council, and he appoints Rulon Allred, who is a naturopath from California, as his successor. As a result, during the last few years of his life, Joseph Musser found himself increasingly isolated. The council rejects Rulon Allred. This results in a gradual schism in the community. So by Musser's death in 1954, the movement had fractured into two factions, one following the old council and a second, much smaller group that looked to Rulon Allred and the new priesthood council for leadership.
So by this point, a healthy and, let's be honest, understandable dislike for government had really set in. After hearing stories of the raids in the 1880s from their parents and grandparents, fundamentalists had been through their own refiner's fire. Just like with their ancestors, the pressure had been building from the small-scale arrests in 1935, intensely ramping up to the much larger scope 1945 imprisonments. But these paled in comparison to the coordinated assault on Short Creek in 1953, when hundreds of police officers flooded into the quiet town, arresting all the men and women and taking the children. The whole episode was a PR disaster and caused severe trauma in the community. And we've seen this time and again. Think Waco. While nothing on the scale would happen for the next 50 years, the painful memory of the raid lingered and still lingers in the collective memory of Short Creek.
With this split in the community now set in stone, the much smaller group that stuck with Joseph Musser and then his handpicked successor, Rulon Allred, started to chart their own path. The other faction that followed the old priesthood council settles in behind the leadership of Leroy S. Johnson, who's known to his followers as Uncle Roy. And among these followers are two brothers, Harold and Ray Blackmore. After they'd been excommunicated from the LDS Church for their belief in polygamy, they had founded a small community in their native Canada that they called Bountiful. Harold had traveled down to Salt Lake City to marry a plural wife, a ceremony being performed by Mr. Joseph Musser. And then slowly up in Canada, replicating the pattern from Salt Lake 25 years before, more like-minded individuals kind of gravitate to the Blackmore brothers. Up there, once the full import of the schism between the two groups down in Utah and Arizona gets up there, they decide to stick with Leroy Johnson and the Short Creek group.
And we're going to put a pin in that Canada component, but we're first going to take a deep breath because we're finally ready to talk about the direct connection to Under the Banner of Heaven.
Are you ready, people? We finally made it here.
It's been an hour, Brian.
We have to set the stage. You've got to build foundation here. So you've got these two groups now that have formed, but you've also got an underlying concern from some members of the council. Because, like we talked about, the original purpose was to keep polygamy going. That's it. No extracurriculars. With all this talk about starting churches and groups, some of these men, guys like Lewis Kelch, were getting concerned that this is all going to get to be something bigger than they could handle. And some people then and now agree with Kelch. And so they maintain what they call an independent position. They're fundamentalists. They practice polygamy. They think mostly in the same way, but they just won't join a group or recognize the authority of that group. Then on the other end, the lack of cohesive groups leads some of these guys in the years following the split to decide that they're actually the ones that have the sealing keys and they're called to lead new groups. We'll call them Ones Mighty and Strong. One of these guys is a man named Robert Crossfield. And for those of you watching the series, we're going to call him Onias. And what's so interesting is his grandfather was named Onias Crossfield because, of course, it was.
So Robert Bob Crossfield, he went by Bob. We're not just being rude. Everyone called him Bob. Was born right as the fundamentalist movement was getting started, but miles away in none other than British Columbia, Canada, on July 23rd, 1929, which has, again, its own history of Mormon fundamentalism. Fundamentalism. It can happen anywhere. In his account of his life, the birth almost killed his mother, who required transfusions and a diet of calves' livers to sustain her after birth. I mean, do you really need an excuse to eat calves' livers? I don't know. Bob was a sickly child, born into a working class family and faced financial hardships. His dad worked in roofing for $1 a day. And as finances worsened around his family, exacerbated by the Great Depression, they ended up moving to a homestead in 1934. And his childhood was marked by many moves, including to Edmonton, Alberta, another home of polygamy. And it was in Alberta that Bob enrolled in Canadian Nazarene College, now Ambrose College, a school run by the Nazarene Church. Go Fighting Horsemen of the Apocalypse. I'm just kidding. Their mascot is the Lions. Anyway, he recalled that many of the students saw ministry after school and would pray vocally for hours. It seemed to kind of, I don't know, annoy him. But his roommate, Eldon Maddie, was raised Mormon. In his school theology class, Bob remembers being told that Mormons were heretics. But he didn't really think too much about their doctrines, and despite not having a strong impression from his roommate, this young man was Bob's first encounter with the faith. I'm sure he has thoughts, that roommate. I don't know. But by this time, Bob explains that he knew there was a God who answered prayer, but the identity of that God was a mystery.
Then at age 19, Bob develops tuberculosis. And if you've been listening to our earlier episodes, you're already shaking your head thinking, geez, guys, we're in the 20th century. We're still talking about tuberculosis. I'm sorry, I share your pain. Bob was bitter and he knew the illness would change the trajectory of his life. He just wasn't sure in what direction. When he's in the hospital, a nurse found him reading the Bible. She then approached him and mentioned there was another Bible called the Book of Mormon. Bob puts it on the shelf in his room, forgot about it until boredom set in and he thought, what the heck, I'll read the Book of Mormon. As he read it, he, quote, realized more and more of its truthfulness and the awful state of my own salvation. By the time I was finished, I was stunned, for there was no doubt in my mind that it was true, and it was shortly after this that my whole room was filled with light, and the Spirit bore sure witness that it was the Word of God. Then, the same nurse, the greatest member missionary in history, brings in the Doctrine and Covenants, the Pearl of Great Price, other pamphlets. She calls the missionaries. Within days, Bob comes to believe all of this is true. He's 21 years old when he converted to the LDS Church in 1950. Now, despite that conversion, despite that ardent belief, the LDS Church left him disappointed. The congregations he attended, they weren't lively. He didn't see the spiritual gifts manifest in the church. And this disappointment, surprise, led to personal gospel study. And perhaps you can start to see where this is going to go.
And it can't be overstated enough that Bob wasn't really special when it came to this. Throughout the 70s, 80s, and 90s, men held gospel study classes in their home to talk about the deep doctrines they weren't learning in church. And this became a problem so much so that the church actually ended up cracking down on this. And more often than we'd expect, these men sometimes became the prophet in their own right. And their study group stopped being students and started being followers. At this time, we have men like James D. Harmston founding the True and Living Church of Jesus Christ of Saints of the Last Days, Roger Billings founding the Church of Jesus Christ in Zion, Alex Joseph founding the Church of Jesus Christ in Solemn Assembly. The list goes on and on and on, world without end. Amen.
Now, this is the point when things change, because in 1961, Bob received a revelation, the first of many. He was told, quote, "I have chosen thee to be a prophet unto this people. Beware even the then current president of my church, even David O. McKay, for he pretendeth revelation. But he doth know, and I your Savior know, he receiveth no revelation." So the disappointment Bob felt wasn't because the gospel wasn't true. It was because he was being led by someone who had gone astray. And in his later revelations, you can see they start to support early fundamentalist teachings. He says he heard the voice of God speak about the 1886 revelation, for example. Up there in British Columbia, he becomes acquainted with that group up there that becomes the FLDS and their leadership. He actually even calls Uncle Roy himself to repentance by way of revelation in 1974. And what's interesting, given all of this, he wasn't excommunicated until 1972. Within 7 years, Bob compiles his revelations into the Book of Onias, the name that Bob received for himself. And for those that came to believe in his revelations, Bob becomes a forerunner like Moses. This claim, of course, conflicted with the established leadership of the fundamentalists in British Columbia, which definitely causes tension, and Bob just leaves the community.
Now, in the time before he starts his own group, Bob starts receiving many revelations that he eventually compiles into the Second Book of Commandments. And by many, I mean he ends up with over 200 revelations. On February 11th, 1975, Bob received one of the most well-known of his revelations, called Section 24, or the Parable of the Pear Tree. This revelation showed Bob that the LDS Church had come under condemnation. God was calling them to repentance and to a cleansing. Section 24, along with another that expressed God's condemnation for lifting the priesthood and temple ban, ended up getting mailed to local Mormon leadership as pamphlets. And I want to note that that's not uncommon. We see that in most Mormon fundamentalist communities. And then on May 6th, 1982, while in Boise, Idaho, Bob received a revelation to set up the School of the Prophets. Now, this was not a church, and there was no missionary work. The goal was just to educate the faithful of Zion, who were called by revelation to join the group. And the purpose was just to compile and study Bob's revelations and teach those who then felt called to join. It's kind of like an MLM, but with the gospel. The group was presided over by Bob and six counselors. Now, here's where we get into the series. Ron and Dan Lafferty were two of these counselors. Ron and Dan were called to join the group in a revelation that went unpublished that was later printed in January 8, 1984. In the revelation, God revealed to Bob, quote, "And I call my servants Daniel, Ronald, Watson, and Timothy to my school. And I call my servant Ronald to be a bishop in the United Order in this part of my vineyard, and that he be not a counselor, but a teacher, that he may impart his knowledge in the school."
And if those other brothers' names sound unfamiliar, it's because they are not those names in the series. We'll talk about that later. I have to say, though, a parable in a pear tree sounds like the worst Christmas song of all time. I'm not listening to all those verses. So the year after that, Bob received a revelation to build an endowment house. They believed that in time, the Cardston Temple would be cleansed and given to the true saints, Bob's followers. However, until then, an endowment house would just have to do. And interestingly enough, Salem, Utah was chosen by Revelation as the site. On June 2nd, 1979, he recorded, quote, "And ye have asked me where ye should gather, and behold, I say unto you that I have chosen a place of refuge, even Salem, Utah, yea, even that city which my servant John Coyle saw, even shall be built up, and all the land around about is sacred unto me." And they get bonus points for using the sacred even like 12 times there. All right, this guy John Coyle, sounds like it's tangent time again. John Coyle was an LDS man who had a vision in 1894 of Moroni, who showed him a Nephite mine. You're thinking like Uncle Scrooge piles of gold here. And this mine would, quote, "come in at the right time when the saints needed it." As promises of piles of gold tend to do, it piqued people's interest and they started digging. 15 years later, the mine was incorporated and stock was sold. And now it's probably a good time to report that I am a proud stockholder. My certificate is on my wall behind me. John Coyle was actually the bishop of his ward when they started selling stock, and that definitely raised some eyebrows down at headquarters. So apostle and scientist James Talmadge was sent to investigate, and he reports back the mine is just complete nonsense. It was such a buzzkill. People, however, continued to buy stock and dig and believe in Coyle until Coyle is finally forced to sign a statement saying that his revelations were just a bunch of crap. However, he rethought his course and retracted that statement and was then promptly excommunicated in 1948 and died kind of a sad man the following year. That, however, was not the end of the mine. It continues to draw people, both LDS and fundamentalists, until the present day.
So in addition to buried treasure or whatever, polygamy became a central part of Bob's movement. We're all surprised. In 1983, he revealed the language for the sealing that included the law of Sarah, which, for those non-Mormons listening, that is the law of bringing another wife into the family. Around the same time, Bob began reprinting and circulating The Peacemaker, a pamphlet printed in Nauvoo by Adnihei Jacob, with Joseph Smith listed as the printer. Among other things, the document defended polygamy, or celestial marriage. But stay tuned for that. There'll be another episode.
As an aside, if you know you've been watching Under the Banner of Heaven, people have been wondering about these accusations of fornication that seem synonymous with actually disobedience. And this idea comes from Bob Grossfield, actually. In his revelation on marriage and divorce, he wrote, quote, "Fornication, as it is generally understood, is the lewdness of unmarried persons. Since a married woman cannot thus commit fornication, the fornication of the wife against her husband must be a different kind of fornication." So according to Bob, the alienation of the mind is fornication for a woman. A wife is bound to obedience. Disobedience was fornication for Bob.
And that wasn't Bob's only problematic view of marriage, but we digress. The Laffertys were only really associated with Bob for a few months, but those months were intense. In 1985, Bob documented the controversy between Ron and Dan Lafferty and the school. Early on, Ron and Dan were captivated by Bob, even sending copies of his revelations to their local ward and stake leaders. Their enthusiasm led Ron and Dan even to volunteer the Lafferty family home that the boys were raised in for printing and folding the school pamphlets, as well as holding their public meetings. Yes, some people's spiritual gift is putting away chairs in the gym. I don't know. Some's folding pamphlets. Degrees of priesthood, degrees of glory. Among the revelations the men were attracted to was section 106 of Bob's scriptures. The section called all men to receive revelation. Quote, "When a man or woman receives a revelation pertaining to their own calling in Zion, it shall be brought before the school in their area, and they can receive confirmation from me whether it should be acted upon or not, or whether it be from me or from another source."
Bob also noted that Ron had a personality that would change frequently. In Ron's bishop role, he would express anger, he would criticize those around him. Crossfield also noted that the brothers had a lot of hostility towards Babylon. This is just basically anything with the government. Crossfield also recalled Ron receiving revelations right after he joins the group. One of them, that's rejected by the School of the Prophets, expressed that sex was for the purpose of procreation and renewing the marital covenant. However, it had to be initiated by the wife or wives, of course. This is a polygamy deal. Bob also noted that Ron participated in a plural sealing without a ceremony that was justified by revelation, he thought. And it was on this day the revelation was rejected that one member of the group, Barry Crowther, claimed to see a, quote, hidden revelation that ultimately justified the murder of Brenda and Eric Lafferty. This is that removal revelation. Barry penned an affidavit, but didn't notify police or warn any of them that were in danger. And I would argue that this course of action was, like, not helpful to anyone.
No, not at all. So, like everything else in Mormon history, the story of the Laffertys didn't happen in a vacuum. Their behavior was built on a very long history of Mormon fundamentalism. And then that augmented their own mania. While it is, of course, completely true that their evil actions do not represent Mormonism, LDS or fundamentalist, that doesn't mean that the course they took before getting to this point is completely unexplainable. Hopefully, this brief overview provides some context and a jumping off point for further discussion.
Thanks for joining us, friends, for this discussion. We hope you liked it. Remember, we'll keep doing other discussions and we'll do some deep dives into each of the episodes and talk about what's going on there. But we appreciate you joining us and we hope you enjoy the rest of these.
Thanks, brother. I beg you, spill my blood, oh brother Young. And let it smoke sent to heaven, brother Brigham, brother Young. And let my breast be cut asunder, brother Young. As an offering for my sins, a smoking incense, brother Young. A blood atoning for my sinning, brother Young. Cause I sinned so gravely, brother Brigham, brother Young. I sinned so gravely, brother Young. Let only you can save me, brother Brigham, brother Young. But only
the song you heard today is called Brother Brigham, Brother Young by an artist, Corb Lund. Check out his music at corblund.com. And consider giving a donation to sunstone.org to support this podcast.